For generations, Native American children in this country were taken from their homes and sent away to boarding schools. This went on for 150 years. And now the federal government is trying to account for this dark, horrific chapter to this country's history. In the first of several reports, the Interior Department in May documented the history of these schools and the cultural annihilation that children experienced on the inside. The department found 53 burial sites on boarding school campuses. Deb Holland is the first Native person to serve in a cabinet position. She's the Interior Secretary. And she recently told NPR why the government operated or supported more than 400 of these boarding schools between the years 1819 and 1969.
They had already committed genocide against the Indians, and they worked very hard to kill as many off as they could, but it was impossible to kill them all off. So finally, it was thought if they can take the children away from their families, assimilate them, turn them into essentially into white people, then they wouldn't have that problem anymore.
47 of these schools were in Arizona, the most prominent, the Phoenix Indian. It opened in 1891 and operated for nearly a century. Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd went to the site.
Now, one thing to know about Phoenix Indian is that the campus is right here in the heart of central Phoenix. I can see the tall buildings of downtown right in front of me. And these cars that you can hear zooming past, they are driving on Indian School Road. Ask anyone in town and they'll tell you they've driven down it 1,000 times. But if you ask them why it has that name, my guess is they would have no idea about the traumatic history they are driving right past.
There's a big round sidewalk and it's called the Circle of Life.
Molita Yazzi knows that history well. She runs the school's visitor center, and she's showing me what's left of the campus. It's a hot June afternoon. The trees don't offer enough shade on the sidewalk. Even the gurgling fountain seems thirsty.
That building there is the Memorial Hall. So these three buildings were the only three buildings of the whole campus that are still standing.
Oh, really? So yeah. A lot came down?
Yeah. Yeah. It's gone.
Yazzi shows me the old dining hall. It's gorgeous. One-story red brick. Looks like an old mission built 120 years ago. I tap on the window and peer inside. There's an old sink and a broken stove.
There's holes in the ceiling there.
Yeah.
But it's interesting because you can kind of just, it feels like time kind of stopped inside there, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's all these bricks laying. Look at those heavy doors on this side, on the right side.
Do you sometimes imagine what it would have been like?
Yeah, I can just hear the echo and slamming of dishes, children talking.
In the early days, the children who used this dining hall were forced to wear military uniforms. The unfamiliar food they ate made them sick. Their hair was cut short, their indigenous names erased.
They just looked at you and said, your name is John, and your birth date is February 10th.
According to a local museum, the Indian commissioner traveled to Phoenix in 1890 and said it was cheaper to educate Indians than to kill them. By the turn of the century, Phoenix Indian was home to about 700 students. Up to 20 of them would try to run away every month. There was a posse in charge of finding them. It's hard not to think about the children who suffered here as we walk this path that represents the circle of life. And yet, there are signs that children played here. Yazzi shows me the eastern facade of Memorial Hall. Over the years, hundreds of students have etched their names into the soft red brick.
1952. Ed. Some of them have their nicknames on there. It's Boney.
Boney.
I can't deny it. There's the evidence carved in brick.
Well, you were a teenager. We'll forgive you.
Yeah, defacing government property, but who cares, right?
Patty Talahongva lived on campus in 1978.
And my sister, Rosalie, her name, she carved her name in the brick, but she won't own up to it.
Talahongva is Hopi. She spent her junior year at Phoenix Indian. Her mother had a tough choice to make. Talahongva's father had just died, and there wasn't room in a small apartment for all the kids. So Patty and her sister had to move more than 100 miles away.
The day we arrived, there were Trailways buses and Greyhound buses, bumper to bumper to bumper, all of the students. And people were getting out and, you know, hugging each other and happy to be back together. And it was chaotic.
It's important to know that Phoenix Indian was a very different place by the time Talahangva arrived. Reforms to native schools began slowly in the 1920s after a scathing report highlighted the atrocities and the dismal education happening there. In 1978, Talahangva could dress however she wanted. I could see she had style as we flipped through her yearbook.
There I am.
Oh, there you are.
With really long bangs.
I was just going to say, I love your bangs.
Oh, my goodness.
It was the late 70s. What are you going
to
do?
Yeah, well, they needed to be feathered more.
Talahangva remembers remnants of the school's military history. The students had to buff the floors and make their beds with military precision. But she also liked it there and made friends from tribes she didn't know much about before.
Oh, those Apaches with their headbands. They were a lot of fun. Ute Mountain Utes, they had their powwow drum, and they would set it out on the campus, and you could hear that drum all over. Mm. So when I came to school at Phoenix Indian, the government had finally decided that it wasn't good to suppress the language. So culture was very much embraced when I went to school there, but that only came about after decades of harsh treatment, just totally trying to wipe out the culture. And finally, you know, they realized, okay, that's not working.
Help me understand that. How did it go from these places that suppressed the culture to a community where you could celebrate it and in fact share your culture with each other?
It was not just at the boarding schools, but you know, just think about the tone of the country and how things were changing with the African American population. And that kind of brought the Native American population along too. And the other thing is, some of these students, they still went to college. They exceeded the expectations of the boarding school and went off and got their education and then came back. That change helped shape the direction of the schools.
I understand there was a program where people from the community, from the city, would come onto campus and they would hire you for odd jobs. Anybody could come and do this. What was that about?
Yeah, just what you said. It's well documented that the schools were meant to produce a cheap labor force. It was called the Phoenix Indian Industrial School. We were looked at as cheap labor.
Did you go out?
Yeah, I went out too. Girls got housekeeping and boys got yard work.
In the context of all this, I wonder what your thoughts are on the conversation that we have been having around the country, not only in this country actually, but in Canada as well, where we've been, the rest of us have been learning the history about the unmarked graves and some of the atrocities that happened on these campuses over the many, many decades that they've been in existence. What do you think about all that?
Well, for us in Indian country, you know, we know the history of the boarding schools because we've lived it. And we know that so many kids never came home. And we know they died at the schools. What happened to them? The rest of the world is finally catching up to what we've known for decades. And I would put it back to you and just say, really think about if this happened to your grandparents. You know that an aunt or uncle died at a boarding school and they were never returned home. Mm. How do you have closure? And especially if you have ceremonies that you're supposed to do when someone passes away to take care of them for the next world, and you never get that opportunity. It's just awful.
And yet, as far as we know, there's no official record of grave sites at this campus. Should they be looking?
Oh, absolutely.
But the question is, where? Today, most of the campus is a city park. I asked a spokesperson if they'd ever searched for human remains. The answer was no. The city's archaeologist has seen no evidence of a cemetery. But Molita Yazi says there is an obvious place to look.
So, right here in this area, right here, in this corner, it's where the hospital used to be for the school.
We're standing in front of a dirt lot, fenced off, full of weeds.
There's nothing there right now, and I think with Deb Holland's initiative, this piece of land here is going to come into contention sooner or later because it was a hospital.
Which means people may have died in that
potentially,
area.
Potentially, yeah. Very, very possible. We don't know, but it's possible.
Over the course of 100 years,
yeah.
Possible, probably likely.
Yeah.
The owner of this small parcel is a private real estate developer. I called and emailed. No one returned my messages. In the 1990s, a researcher named Owen Lindauer led an excavation at a different site on campus. They unearthed artifacts like buttons and glass. Lindauer told me they also found plenty of bones, but none of them human. He also said there's no doubt children died here, but his research shows the bodies were either sent home or buried in a city cemetery. For Melita Yazzie, who is Navajo, it is almost too much to bear.
You can only imagine, you know, what the children went through. Pass away, not being with your family, you know. So that's what I think of. It's hard. How could this have happened, you know?
The Interior Department investigation into Native boarding schools is ongoing. Last month's report says it expects to find more grave sites on campuses across the country. Whether anyone will search at Phoenix Indian is unclear.